welcome to In Context, WPKN's live public affairs call-in show. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. You can hear In Context every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month when WPKN's general manager, Steve, reports to listeners. Our website is incontextreport.com, and you can check out our videos on YouTube. My co-host, Gus Canavero, is away, but we're very fortunate to have in the studio as our guest co-host, Jeep Ward, whose music show was heard on WPKN every Tuesday morning from 7 to 9.
Yep, mornings.
And mornings. And what's your website, Jeep?
It's halodoesntsuck.com.
I love it. Okay, thanks a lot, Jeep. And today's show, as Jeep said earlier, we're going to talk about food, both in terms of our personal health, but also in terms of food public policy. And we're very fortunate to have with us today a guest who's been focusing on both aspects of the food issue. So, Jeep, could you please introduce Elliot?
Yes. Her name is Elliot Snaith. She recently graduated from right here in Connecticut, Western Connecticut State University, with a double degree in anthropology and sociology, as well as graduating summa cum laude,
what?
Which is better than magna cum laude, which I did not know until she graduated summa cum laude. She is well-versed in all types of food security issues, wrote many, many papers, has spoken at the UN, you were a guest at the UN, and you helped to name a UN conference. It was called H2UO, which was an amazing name, and that was about water security. But either way, she's well-versed in food security issues, and I'm really, really excited to have her on and have her say here, talking about what's going on with food and how it affects the health of America. So, let's get
all
into
right.
it.
Well, thanks, Jeep.
Let's give a round of applause for Elliot Snaith.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us, Elliot. The U.S. GDP is almost one-fifth devoted to health care costs, and about three-quarters of all of our health care spending goes for the treatment of chronic diseases. So to what extent do you think that these huge expenditures are due to the American diet?
Well, thank you, first of all, for inviting me on. I really appreciate it. But I would say a lot of it, I actually got into agriculture because I was interested in healthcare and how we can reduce those costs. The way to make healthcare the cheapest is to not get sick. And part of the reasons that we get sick so often is because we're lacking essential vitamins and nutrients in our diet. So I started looking at why are we lacking those things, and kind of ended up falling down a rabbit hole of public policy, lobbyists, as well as I did experiment a little with the cultural side, being an anthropologist, of meat consumption and how that is seen as a status symbol. But that almost seems to be less intrinsic in American culture now than is the constant lobbying messages that we get about how meat is so good for us. And I'm a meat eater. I'm not some crazy, Bible thumping
vegan,
or anything like that. I eat meat, I eat dairy, etc. But I do try to focus a lot now more on growing my own food and ways that we can grow food effectively and efficiently.
What do you think are the worst culprits in the American diet?
As far as a personal health issue?
Yes. Twinkies.
Yeah, I mean, you walk through the supermarket, and what are the things that the aisles that people should avoid?
Gosh, there's a lot of those. If you spend 50% of your time in the produce section while you're in the supermarket, you're probably doing really well. But even then, we've got to look at the problem that what supermarket are you going to? Where is their food coming from? And what's helping you decide which of those produce options you're going to go for? Most of us, like myself, don't have a lot of money, so we'll opt for a cheaper option. But then you find out that your 5 cloves of garlic or 5 heads of garlic for $2 is coming from China, and you start thinking about what are the health risks associated with that food? What are the how long is it going to last? It's already had a very long shelf life being shipped over. How much more time are you going to have before you have to use that garlic? That, and you're not supporting our American farmers anymore. You're supporting a farm company far, far away. So if you're changing not only where you're at in the supermarket, but which markets you're going to, you can see a huge change in your own health and diet. You'll have more nutrition in your food, more vitamins that are available and haven't broken down during that shelf time.
Well, the Center for Disease Control says that 35% of Americans are obese, which I think I looked it up. What's obese? It's if you're 5'9" and you're over 200 pounds. You're considered obese by the CDC,
wow.
Which I think that's pretty chunky. So it's not like pleasantly plump.
Yeah.
You know, so 35% of people are over that line.
That Botticelli, Zoftic line.
Exactly. I know it's beyond any kind of even Raphael idea of beauty. What are the worst things? Is it the McDonald's? Is it the fast foods? Is it the heavily packaged stuff? What adds the weight to people then?
The weight comes from a lot of different things for sure, but definitely the packaging, the fact that we do a lot of salts and oils in our foods, and we have foods that we don't want to spend the money on, so they have to have a longer shelf life. If you look at basic economics, it makes no sense for a food distributor to be selling cheaper raw foods that have a short shelf life.
Right.
They're going to have a lot of risk to absorb there. So it's easier to stock a whole lot of heavily preserved foods like your Twinkies, which will last forever, giving you an infinite amount of time to sell.
Just check any corner store. Basically, any product that's sold at your local corner store, if you're in an urban area, it's like, you know, if you go to, you know, like Brooklyn or even in Manhattan, there are some of these like bougie type of gourmet bodegas that are popping up, which is a good thing. And it shows like a little bit of shift in consumption culture. But your average corner store, whatever they're stocking
is
going to stick around until it gets dusty, and they can still blow the dust off it and sell it and it won't be bad.
It's amazing. And if you look at it by the weight, I mean, I looked at like the Doritos shelf, and you consider how if they're getting like $3 a bag and there's like, I don't know, 8 ounces or 10 ounces a bag.
Yeah.
If you started to figure it out by the pound, they were getting like $20 a pound for the stuff, which I guess has very little nutritional value.
Yeah, it has almost no nutritional value.
And the potato itself was maybe $80 a pound, maybe $1 a pound.
Not even. I mean, for the people who are producing and processing, it's less than a penny.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So these guys are making unbelievable amounts of money, and it lasts forever.
Well, processed foods, it's like cigarettes. It's that cheap.
Yeah.
You know? And it's crazy. I mean, speak a little bit more about it. I mean, I just have a cursory knowledge of these things just from, you know, hearing more about these things and being interested in my own health.
Yeah. What about the additives, for example? I mean, there's like, what about the corn syrup and all that stuff that seems to...
All of that. I mean, I find corn syrup a fascinating subject unto itself. We didn't really start producing corn syrup until we had an abundance of corn that we did. What are we going to do with it? And that really started in 1975 when Earl Butz was like, break down the barriers, break down the fences. We used to be subsidizing farmers to grow a little bit less. We always wanted to protect both our consumers. We didn't want food prices to skyrocket and become unaffordable. But at the same time, we needed to protect the farmers' interests and make sure they could always make a profit. And it wasn't going to become a flooded market where suddenly products pricing were going way down.
So this isn't back under Ford. Right? 75.
Yeah.
Right? And the idea was to get away from price supports, maybe deregulate the industry.
Right.
So let's find out some other uses for corn.
Bigger was better. So break it down and grow whatever you're doing. You know, do lots of corn, do lots of beans. You know, you want to rotate your crops so that you're not completely depleting the soil. But that also started bringing in a lot more heavy tractoring and destroying a lot of land. The soil depletion over time due to all that heavy tilling. Every time you break the earth, nutrients come up, which is what gives us our first initial burst in the yield. But over time, those nutrients start to erode and wash away with rain, and you can't really till deep enough, so you have to start adding synthetic fertilizers to get the same amounts of yields that you were, say, 2 years ago. So what ended up happening there is people started losing out. Only the big farmers were able to buy up more land. Smaller farmers who maybe hit a rough patch 1 year with a drought or some other condition ended up closing down, and you started to see just massive monocrops of corn happening. By 1986, 10 years later, they've shown drastic, drastic changes in that entire economy where poverty suddenly starts to skyrocket. There's a lot of homeless people, and there's obesity crises out there because it's a food desert. Iowa grows most of our corn, but they only grow, I think, 7% of their own food, and all of that other food is brought in from either other countries or other places in the United States.
So the corn syrup seems to end up in everything we eat. Does it have any nutritional value?
No.
It's just a sweetener?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just sweet.
I mean, you pick up your barbecue sauce. It seems like you pick up anything, and it's got corn syrup in it.
It's a cheap additive. It's a great filler. It's a sweetener. People apparently like it because
everybody loves sugar.
A lot of it.
I mean, you know, if you've ever seen or read Botany of Desire, I mean, one of the biggest motivating things for humanity has been the search for sweetness. Mm. You know what I mean? There've been studies and studies and studies that, like, wherever sweet things are, people will gravitate towards. So using that knowledge, they're like, well, you know, we have this abundance of corn. Let's make this corn syrup. And then we can put it in everything. And then people will want to buy more of these products.
Sure. And you're into stuff that's not nutritious either.
Yeah.
It's so like, I got a package of stuff that's completely worthless, but tastes sweet.
Yeah. It's like if you've ever tasted homemade barbecue sauce or like real barbecue from like someplace in Texas or, you know, I've gotten it in Arkansas, it tastes totally different. It's not sweet at all. It's like almost bitter. You know, and that's, everybody's like, oh, I don't really like it. You know, I like the Hunts better because we're trained to want this sweetness, you know, not to actually have flavors. We just want to have like a little bit of flavor and mostly sweetness.
Well, corn syrup should never have happened.
No.
It wasn't.
Yeah.
It was a very like resource and labor intensive product to make, but it's because we do have so much corn and we've been feeding it to our livestock forever, which is fine for pigs, but ruminants, like cows, can't handle it. They need grasses and grains, and feeding them corn causes ulcers and all kinds of other problems. But yet we continue to do it because we just have so much. We had a huge export market when these policies were first in place, and then we had the quote-unquote Green Revolution. I call it the Black Revolution because it was basically oil. It wasn't about growing food.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the... Well, I just want to ask one more thing about what's on our food, and then I want to talk about the structure of the industry.
Oh, yeah.
Pesticides. How bad are they for us, do you think?
I personally...
Super.
I think if it's killing other organisms, it's probably going to kill you too, whether it's on a higher level or a lower level. That and the pesticides that we're using are often specifically targeted, and what happens is you have adaptation and evolution, and for whatever reason this country still has huge pockets that refuse to acknowledge that evolution occurs. But even on a small molecular level, we've seen it happen. We know that it does happen, and these pests begin to evolve more and more to avoid the pesticides. And at the same time, we're doing these monocrop fields, which is basically a huge buffet for pests. You know, if you're a gnat and your favorite thing to feed your maggots is corn, and there's 75 acres of corn right in front of you, your population of pests is going to explode. And in the meantime, all your pesticides have killed off all of the other beneficial insects in the area that might have been eating those maggots, those larvae, and helping to keep the pest production under control naturally.
Is there anything that people can do who can't afford to eat organic can do to their fruits and vegetables to
grow your own?
Yeah, I mean, you can wash them and wash them, but since those pesticides are applied almost throughout the entire lifespan of the crop, it's almost inherent in your foodstuffs now, at least traces of it.
Yeah, you know, we never do really good studies of the cancer-pesticide connection. I'm not aware of it. And yet, it just seems there's a steady increase in these chronic diseases like
cancer,
diabetes.
Well, there's a reason why
diabetes.
There aren't any studies on
right,
that.
Right, yeah. Exactly. We don't want to know. You know, ignorance is bliss.
Yeah.
And it just seems like there's got to be a reason why everybody gets sicker. It seems to get sicker
absolutely,
every year.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And I mean, it's like been 40 years since Nixon declared war on cancer, which he probably had good intentions, but there's more cancer every year.
You can always say that. You know, it's a good lip service to say, I declare war on this, and then be like,
well, we're on drugs. We have no drug problem anymore, right?
We're in Dear Gandhi, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Ali, let's get into, like, how did this industrial system of farming, it's called agribusiness. Mm. I mean, what is it, and how did it get started?
Well, agribusiness really is a huge machine. And like I said, we've always had government monies that we earmarked for agriculture. Because food security, which is, you know, part of what we're talking about today, the idea that if your population is well fed, you're less likely to have civil disturbances, and therefore you have a more secure homeland. And when it changed in 1975 from the more sustainable small farms into these sort of go big or go home, we'll export it out, and, you know, money, dollar is king, you started to see more lobbyists, more people invested in the money side of it. So big oil had a big part to play in making sure that tractors continue to be used. We were talking earlier about how fertilizers in the 1906, I think, they invented how to come up with synthetic ammonia from fossil fuel wastes and things
so
like that.
So from the early days, there was this oil industry connection. In fact, there was a Rockefeller connection with agribusiness, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they were, as I understand it, from
Jay-Z?
From William Engdahl wrote his book, Seeds of Destruction. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but he says they actually, after World War II, started to buy huge plantations in Latin America with the idea of doing to agriculture what they'd done to oil, which is concentrating control in the hands of a couple corporations and marrying the oil to the agriculture.
And it certainly is. It's almost, you can't untangle them anymore. And so many, there's some great documentaries that are out there about it. King Corn is one of them. Ingredients is another great one that goes from the farmer's perspective and talks about these farmers that were small, you know, their family farm had been there forever and they lose it, you know, in the 80s or so because they can't keep up with the competition from the larger producers. They either have to buy into a consolidated contract and then they're basically tenant farming their own land, or they'll close, and you're starting to see more like chef's garden, sustainable farming operations that are still industrial in the sense that they are producing a large enough surplus that it's all going out into a market, but they're doing a larger diversity of plants and really they're farming soil. So by focusing on how do we get the best quality soil, they're producing high yields of really high quality products that have a market, and they're all doing much, much better.
So it isn't necessarily productive, but the Rockefellers had this idea that we can use the oil from, fertilize from oil. So now you're going to have this chemical fertilizer,
right.
But you're also going to use a lot of John Deere farm equipment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is going to guzzle oil like crazy.
And it's cheap and easy. When we changed over so that we were doing huge corn subsidies, which we still do now when we talk about ethanol, actually, more than corn syrup, which is
E85, son.
There's like tons of texts about how that is just the worst thing we could be doing with our agricultural land because it's useless, really. But
it's feeding the cars.
It's feeding cars, yeah. And we still have hungry people all over. So what's going on with that? We have some serious problems with how we assume that our production has to be, because the government says you've got a guaranteed market if you're selling to us. And they, as Americans, we are losing because they are upping what the market price for grain is to make it worth the farmer's while. And at the same time, that farmer is taking a huge risk, assuming that they will be able to make enough with that after buying the ammonia, after buying the oil, after, you know, updating tractors and buying seed, because now we've got Monsanto and, you know.
Well, talk about Monsanto and how it fits into the agribusiness.
That's scary.
Because that's the giant now.
There's boys waiting outside.
Right. I know, right?
We can talk about it. This is WPKN, and we're on the air thanks to our generous listeners. So we can talk about Monsanto.
That's right. That's
so
right.
Thank you very much, listeners. And if you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5. FM, streaming at WPKN.org, and we're on every Monday from noon to 1, except the first Monday of the month. And we're talking today about food, about how it affects your personal health, but also public policy as it relates to food and the evolution of this industrial agribusiness that now dominates our market. And we're speaking with food expert Elliot Snaith, and with me is my guest co-host, Jeep Ward.
Hey, hey.
Yep.
So Monsanto, let's get into it.
All right, they're scary.
Go in.
Very scary company, but it comes back to the idea that we need to make money. Everyone is trying to get out for that dollar, so it's a really good idea to patent a natural product that you're adjusting. What's interesting about Monsanto is they are, I'm currently involved in sustainable agriculture and permaculture practices, which is saying, what are the patterns in nature? How do we not fight nature since we spend so much money, so many resources in battling these processes, when really we could just adjust how we're approaching a natural process and get the same kinds of high yields we get in industrial agriculture, such as Monsanto? And they are fighting nature so hard, everything from changing how the plants are genetically formed. Interestingly enough, there was a hand there in the corn syrup production we were talking about earlier, where they increased the starch levels of the kernels, reducing the germ, which is that little part at the bottom when you're biting into your corn cob and you kind of got to dig your teeth in to get that tasty part. And that's where all the vitamins are and all the nutrients. And now that area has physically been reduced due to genetic hybridizing and crossbreeding. And then when they realized that people were able to do their high yield, although low nutrient corn, collecting seed from it, and they couldn't stop, they couldn't sue enough people fast enough for saving seed, they changed it over to have these dead seeds.
So are they still doing, they're doing that now? They have dead seeds?
They have dead seeds.
So the farmer can't replant.
Yeah.
He's got to go to Monsanto every year and buy new seeds.
Go to Monsanto every year and buy new seeds. And what they're doing now, what I've heard about in the works, and I haven't really looked into it in a bit, with the zombie seeds, where you get the seeds, but you can't plant them right away. You have to buy another chemical that will activate the zombie seed to be alive enough just to plant.
It's pretty nefarious, really.
And then even more genius is that it's genetically capable of handling Roundup, a Monsanto chemical product.
This is a
pesticide,
right?
And that's an herbicide.
Herbicide.
And I think they also have
weeds.
Pesticides.
It's basically like Agent Orange.
Okay, Agent Orange for your plants. Yeah.
And that allows it, so you have to buy even more of their products.
So they sell you a seed that will grow a plant that's impervious to the poison of Roundup. Right?
Yeah. It's a tie-in.
You got it. You buy the seeds.
Oh, yeah.
Then you buy the Roundup.
Well, any producer or any business knows that what you're making money on is not necessarily the main product. It's all the accessories and the add-ons.
Mm-hmm. It's the concession stand.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
You know
like
what I mean?
The movie theater.
If you go to a paint store, the paint's not where they're making money on. What they're making money on is the brushes, the like rollers, the wallpaper, the this, the that, you know, all the accents that help you to make
the
product.
Kicker.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I would say that the seed and the fact that you
have
the
seed
to re-buy.
And the like, it's like a developer almost for the seed to be able to like grow. That's absolutely insane.
And then what's even more beautiful is it encourages monocropping in that way that you're buying all this seed, you're going to do the whole, if you're monocropping, you only have to buy one tractor, you don't have to buy multiple different pickers or other kinds of machines. But then you're spraying this pesticide, this herbicide, all over from a plane, which means that winds are taking it further out, you're getting herbicides into your water, etc. And we've had issues of cross-pollination from the Monsanto genetic tagged corn into other cornfields, and then Monsanto's lawyers, or I don't know, like they're bad men. They come to your little local farm and they sue you.
They're like the lawyers from The Simpsons. they're like in the firehouse. They're like, go, go, go.
Yeah.
It seems to me the farmer who gets polluted by this stuff should be suing Monsanto.
It should be. But no, their lawyers are so fast.
It's
like, hey, you, blah, blah, and by the time the guy's thought about it, he's already been out $1 million.
And they have so much power in courts, too. And there's been several cases, a lot of cases that have gone to court. Monsanto has never lost a court case.
It's a deep pocket. Well, I used to be a litigator myself before my radio incarnation. And tell you, it's the client with the deep pocket.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That prevails because you can just bury the other guy and you're going to bankrupt him because at $300-$400 an hour, he's not going to have a chance. And the case that's better prepared is the case that wins.
Yep.
You know, we should open our phone lines now, see if listeners would like to join the conversation on any context. Our phone number is 203-336-9756. And my name is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here with my co-host, Jeep Ward. And we're speaking with Elliot Snaith about food policy, about food, why it isn't more nutritious for you, how much industry controls to our detriment what we eat today. So please give us a ring. One of the things that we were talking about earlier, Elliot, was the idea of vertical integration. I happened to learn recently that this whole name agribusiness was invented at Harvard Business School, you may know, in the 1950s by a guy named Ray Goldberg. And he was working on a project funded by guess who? The Rockefeller brothers, right?
Oh, my goodness.
With a guy named John Davis, who had been the Assistant Secretary of Agriculture under Eisenhower. So these two guys actually cooked up the idea of agribusiness. And later on, Professor Goldberg said the absolute key to his system was vertical integration. Could you talk about what that is in the food industry?
When I think about vertical integration in agribusiness, I do think of sort of, you know, Monsanto and how they they are selling you every product along the way and they're integrating it all. Again, coming from a sustainable side, when I think about vertical integration of products, I'm thinking of the fact that, say, the old family farm, we're not buying ammonia from anyone else. We have it on our farm. Our cow, our dairy cow, is producing the ammonia and the nitrogen, and we're letting her go out and graze in the fallow fields and do her thing, produce her waste there. We think of it as waste now, but it's not really. It's high quality fertilizer. And then next year, next planting season, that fallow field will be absolutely perfect conditions for it. She's been fed without any outside resources coming in. So when you think about how we can integrate our connections with our food, we begin to have more vertical integration. But in agribusiness, it's a scary tangle of lobbies, is what I've noticed, and political pressure coming from, we were even mentioning before, you know, cancer lobbies and healthcare lobbies that necessarily do not want proper diet to be an essential aspect of American culture because it's going to cut into their profits in a humongous way. And that's scary to think about, that somebody out there who we're putting our health in their hands is actually invested in keeping us unhealthy. But I guess that's
it really goes back even to the early days. You've talked about the turn of the century in the meat industry when like these big companies like Swift and Armour, they would get they'd buy the cattle, they'd own the cattle yards, they own the slaughterhouses, then they own the meat packing plants, and then the distribution, they own the distribution network. And I guess people like Upton Sinclair wrote books about the, you know, the jungle, you know, about how bad conditions were. But I think they became kind of a model, which then spread to all aspects of our food.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, it's just a it's a good business model that was developed by Carnegie, where you know he he saw, you know, he was a Scotsman, so he wants to save as much money as possible, and he saw, well, okay, if I'm making steel, right? What if I'm making steel, I'm just wanting to have the output of this one product, but I can save more money and have bigger profits if I own every aspect of the process up to the finished product. And it, I mean, honestly, it's a very, very smart business model. You know, so like with steel, you own all the ore mines, you own the railroads that transport the ore to your facilities, and then you process it and sell it. And then you own where the marketplace that's selling to the end consumer. You know what I mean?
And the end of it all, is the consumer benefit, say in the steel case, or is he going to lose out because of the certain tying arrangements or
whatever?
Well,
yes and no, in the sense that it can keep pricing down, but at the same time, you know, in terms of like with this food, right, where you have this model. I mean, we don't have as much, I don't know that there's as much of a model like the trucking, the distribution channels. I don't know that they're owned by, like, say, a Monsanto or whatever, like farmers, you know. But where it's like one place that you're getting it, unfortunately, there's like no variety. It's like it's the same as the problem with monocropping
like
versus.
McDonald's is pretty integrated, right? The McDonald's goes, they go to the farmers and they buy, have these long-term contracts for the potatoes.
That's really what's fascinating about integration in agribusiness is that it is it's fractured in a way, and that you've got one sort of controlling corporation, say McDonald's, and then you've got contracted farmers, and they don't have any like union rights or ability to collectivize and find out that they're all having the same issues. That's been happening a lot with like the chicken farming, industrial chicken farming. People have lost their homes. They've lost everything because they've signed a small 3-year contract with Purdue, say, or Tyson, and they're basically owned by that company at that point. They have to build as the shed requirements, they have to have the same amount of chickens.
And those sheds are gross.
And they're disgusting. And those animals
250,000 birds. Like diseases that are only exist in those coops happen because there's so many chickens
and
in one area.
And they force feed them, right? So they grow at to maturity in an incredible short
and
time.
The farmers are susceptible to those diseases then, and at any point, these companies retain the right to walk in and say, you didn't follow this specification, or we don't like what you've done with this, your contract is terminated. So you don't even have the guarantee that you thought you did when you signed the contract.
But they'll still take the product.
They won't. No, and then you're left with 700 sick chickens and no money.
You have to incinerate.
You're totally at the mercy. I guess it works for you if you've got a nice relationship with them. But
I don't know if they do nice relationships. It's kind of scary. But if you're out and out and you've got nothing else, what are you going to do? And I think that the way that they keep it fractured is part of that system. It helps them to keep their prices down for the consumer, but what cost is the consumer really paying? Yeah. Outside of economics, we're more prone to diseases. And
what's interesting, like what you said, the cheap food is like, okay, it's cheap coming out of your pocket, but then how much are you spending on, you know, drugs and things because you're unhealthy because of the food? So it's like, what balances out? You know, farmer's market and spend more on localized, organic, and seasonal things. Because part of what the problem is that in America now, we're used to being able to buy blueberries in March.
Right.
You know, or tomatoes at any time of year. And that's just wrong. You know, you can't do that. You should only have certain vegetables during certain seasons. And the problem is that people don't understand. It's like how people have gotten away with meat. You know, meat is no longer an actual animal. You know what I mean? When you talk to somebody about, like, yeah, you know, this is where the cut of meat comes from, most people are like, ew, gross, I don't want to think about that. And that's like, that's an animal that gave its life for you. Like, right. Whether it's a, you know, a healthy animal or not, like, that animal gave its life.
And that's not, that's,
you
a
know,
detachment.
And it needs, really, exactly. Like, nobody understands the hunting aspect of it.
Especially since World War II, I think we've lost all connection.
Yeah, everything is just packaged. It's just in a cellophane wrap.
That reminds me, I saw this sign. It's like a Snooki kind of character, and her
nice.
Quote was, "I don't eat lobsters because they were alive before they killed them."
Oh man! But steak—that's a little different.
Yeah,
you know?
Of that Woody Allen movie where he has to throw, tries to throw in the pot, gets out of the pot. He's with Diane Keaton.
Yeah,
he's trying to fight the lobster in the kitchen floor with a broom.
Oh, that's like there's a Saran Wrap commercial or something where this guy opens his fridge and there's a lobster in there, and he breaks off a bottle. And he's like, it's like when good food goes bad. But you know, other than all joking aside, we have gotten away from the understanding of what goes into creating food that's available for us. You know, it's like a vending culture. We don't understand that this needs to come from somewhere, and it can only grow in a certain season, or, you know, it came from an animal that was alive at one point. Who knows how long ago?
There's, you know, you've talked about the diseases we're getting from our poor nutrition. There's a public policy, it seems, an implication in that is if we spend 20% of our, almost 20% of our GDP on healthcare, which is about double what our competitors in Europe pay. Mm-hmm. I mean, the country's literally, it's a really important a budgetary problem. And we got all mm-hmm. these people who are sick. Shouldn't the government be able to come in and say, you can't put cornstarch in the food. You can't put, like, aspartame
they could,
as a sweetener.
But there's no...
Yeah. Is that some, yeah. But there'll be some people who say, oh, no, it's my... If I want to go to McDonald's and eat junk, that's
well,
my right.
I mean, that would be fine, but the problem is the government is, you know, I'm sure that this is an obvious conspiracy idea, but, you know, the government is in the pocket of these people who it's advantageous for them to have all these additives and do all these things and have it under the nose of an American. You know what I mean?
That's right.
Most people
yeah.
are not aware or haven't thought enough about their food, which seems to be changing. People seem to be having more of an interest in where their food comes from, what the quality of the food is. You know, is it organic? Is it, you know, free range?
Well,
this and that.
I think
but,
an eighth outbreak of salmonella in spinach.
Yeah, exactly.
So maybe it's not going to come if we improve our diet. It's not going to come because the government
it's
said
not going to be
no more
policy.
Because maybe I don't know. Like Monsanto's
power. It has to be consumer based revolution that yeah. will create public policy.
So from the bottom up. Well, that's what we're trying to do, is promote conversation. If you'd like to join this our discussion of food, give us a ring here at In Context, 203-336-9756. It's 203-336-9756. I'm interested in what listeners do to try to eat healthy. Are they growing their own food? Are they going to farmers markets? Are they buying organic at Whole Foods? If you know, that's very expensive if they can afford it.
Yeah. Well, Whole Foods is actually, it's, I mean, it is, it's a nice outlet, but it's also, I forget, there's like a large company that,
oh, I see, that's a part
it's
of a
large,
oh,
yeah. It's owned by a large parent corporation.
So what are people's strategies for trying to eat well, and do they see a role for the government? Like Mayor Bloomberg said, kids in the city shouldn't be drinking these large quantities of soda. Because I guess this it's not just the sweetness in the soda, but actually changes your body if you keep drinking it, right?
Yeah. There's a lot of problems with soda. I mean, everything from like carbonation in drinks and having as many carbonated drinks a day as most people
Although
do.
Seltzer water is delicious.
But it's still, even yeah, and I can't remember. I don't have the report in front of me about that. But yeah, there's issues with just the carbonation, not to mention the sweetness.
Strips calcium from your bones.
And then you start having issues with the flavors, the additive flavors and things that aren't necessarily good for you either.
Sure. I mean, there's nothing real in some of these drinks. It'll just be food coloring.
Well, even the diet ones,
sugar.
You know, the aspartame. I mean, I grew up on diet soda. So I like the cancerous flavor of the aspartame and diet soda, but it's like a knowing, a willful, like, okay, you know, once, twice a month or something like that, I'll have my diet soda or something like that. But, you know, if you're drinking these things 2-3 times every day, yeah, and especially like the 20-ounce sodas, you know, the sugared sodas, because it's a liquid, people don't think about the caloric intake that you're having. But you drink 3, you know, Cokes a day, that's like 500 or 600 calories.
Yeah.
And that's a third of your calorie intake for the day.
And they're not good calories.
No, it's all empty calories. And unless you're doing a lot of aerobic exercise, you're not burning those calories off.
And when you do get sick, and the kids could get diabetes, we've seen this huge upturn in diabetes, who's going to pay for that? Obviously, it ends up being paid for us, everybody, one way or the other. Maybe it's through Medicaid, if their parents are, you know, maybe they're older, it's on Social Security. If not, you know, it's going to push up everybody's rates. So we all have an interest in it. And we don't live in a society where if you get sick, we just push you off on the side of the road to die. I mean, we do have serious problems.
Why not?
Right. We're getting there.
We have really serious problems with our health coverage. But basically, if you abuse your body, the rest of us have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is amazing. Getting back to, like, how can government change it? I've read a lot of stuff on restrictive things, like Bloomberg stopping sugary products from being in schools and things like that. And they've shown that that has less effect than if we were to just change our subsidies. So rather than the United States government in any way imposing anything on the citizens or businesses, the United States government saying, okay, all that corn subsidy money is now going to be going to a different subsidy. Let's say it's going to be going towards sustainable building. So if you can show us that you're reintegrating your farm in a sustainable way and set up this checklist, you could actually start to see serious changes.
What kind of changes would we want farmers to make in order to make healthier food?
Well, a big problem that I have with how food security is being approached here and in other places is the highly specialized rural sector. Obviously, it makes sense to have farms where there's a lot of land, but then you're consistently approaching the problem by producing food farther away from where most of the consumers are. That's going to raise the cost, as you were saying, of these organic foods exponentially every time, including transport, as well as the time that they're being shipped is destroying the nutritional value. So if we see more urban farms being supported via the government, whether that's on rooftops or renovating green spaces in urban areas to be food forests, which are highly productive, very diverse, and figuring out a way of maintenance, whether that's going to be an employee or
Parks and Rec department.
Are we doing it through the government, or is it going to be government support for local individuals saying?
Well, I know in the city, I used to live for a long time in Manhattan, and we had vegetable markets down the street. And I suppose those guys could, you know, they were flexible, they specialized. But if you go to a big supermarket today, I'm sure the guy who runs that supermarket is saying, well, you know, I'd like to buy local, but I have to have, you know, a 1,000 pounds of broccoli every week or whatever the heck it is.
You have to have Brussels sprouts in June.
My customers expect that. How can that system coexist with a kind of a, you know, what you're talking about, smaller urban farms closer to the customer?
Well, I would say that you're still going to have that market available. You're always going to have people who have money who want things when they want it and have the money to pay for it. There's no reason that we should assume that sort of liberal market and food would disappear.
Yeah.
But again, this sort of goes back to the UN document, the Rio World Food Summit 1996, when they wanted food security. How they identified it was when all people at all times have access to sufficient, safe, nutritious food to maintain a healthy and active life, which is a gorgeous goal, but it would be very hard to achieve. And what you essentially need for that is free food available everywhere. And what you could see from that is that your free foods are your whole foods, that you're having to go out and pick and pluck and take care of yourself. But those processed foods that right now we actually have being so cheap artificially, you'd begin to see the cost of those raised for each input. So let's say you want a corn chip. Okay, a corn chip that doesn't have corn syrup in it or Dorito flavoring is going to be less expensive than your Dorito corn chip, which is going to be more expensive because of the extra processing that was involved in that. What we have now is the complete opposite, where your organic plain corn chips that are locally made are going to be like 4 times more than the same amount of a
mass-produced Dorito.
Why is that?
Like, I walk into the store and I say, oh, I'd like to buy that organic broccoli, but it's $4 a pound as opposed to like $1.69.
It's the bigger is better issue of capitalism. If you can produce more in bulk and, again, vertically integrate your stuff, your resources, because you have more capital to invest in integrating that way, you're always going to be able to produce a cheaper product.
So the current economic model we have doesn't seem to be working to help the organic, the locally.
No.
No? I mean, how could it change? We'd have to change the whole model. We'd have to get away from the large store.
Yeah, you would have to basically create more localized regional centers that focus on only having foods produced in a certain region. And, you know, you can't have your Costco or whatever unless it's something like canned goods.
Yes.
And those things could also be canned locally. Like, you know, back in the 50s and the 40s, you know, people had Victory Gardens and knew how to can and jar and do those things so that they could produce these vegetables on their own, but right. keep them. You know what I mean? Now nobody knows how to do any of those things. No, nobody understands how to can or...
Some people do.
Some people do, but it's pretty rare.
Yeah.
But it's very rare, and it's something that I think that the economic model of having these superstores has gotten us away from, where it's like, oh, well, you know, why bother growing and canning
and it is
when
cheap.
I can just
go buy
canned...
I mean, you go into some of these big stores and you can get broccoli. I saw it on sale for 99 cents a pound. That is really inexpensive. And it's good for you. I mean, I don't know how bad the pesticides are that are on it that I'm eating, but I mean, that is really inexpensive.
It's incredibly inexpensive. And when you think about what it would take for you to grow that broccoli yourself, that's where we start to get into the time is money.
We're growing, my wife is growing tomatoes at home, and that's just a nice... activity, and not that many, but I look at the amount of work she's putting in and the number of pounds of tomatoes she's going to get is very small. Mm. And it's just, I'm thinking, well, she enjoys doing it, but it's just not economical.
Well, that, you know, also speaks back to the permaculture and how can I not fight nature? My garden right now, we had wild coriander in like three of the beds all over it. We've left a lot of the old coriander there, and our second round of beans is using that as climbing poles now and trying to keep as much ground cover. Basically letting nature take care of the weeding for me, holding most of my water in the soil, making sure that I've built up biomass and things like that. And I know there are labor-intensive farmers that love it, or home gardeners, and they love being out there working all
day. But you try to keep your labor down.
I hate it.
But so do you feel that what you're doing is economical? I mean, it's healthy, but is it economical?
You know, in the first year it wasn't, and now it is. And by the third year, it's going to end up saving me so much more money. And in 10 years, I'll be able to have an abundance of food produced with almost no labor for myself and no additional inputs. You know what I mean? I'm not bringing in fertilizers. I'm not using anything else. I'm just focusing on how to rotate my crops, growing as much as I can in as small an area as I have. So I'm using my fruit trees to climb up beans and other legumes, nitrogen fixers that are actually pulling nitrogen from the oxygen in the air around them and re-putting it back into the soil so that other plants will then have access to it.
You know, you raised a really interesting point with the idea of free food. And as I think a lot of countries have heavily subsidized food, and I don't think they're heavily subsidizing imported Doritos.
And
I suppose they're heavily subsidizing the fruits and vegetables and
they're not.
No?
Usually subsidies are going to cereals and monocropped cereals, which are then...
In like in places like Egypt?
It's all wheat and rice.
It's wheat and rice.
See.
And it can go really bad when you have a blight or a drought or any condition that can't handle it. Whereas if you take a more diverse approach to your farming, so let's say we've got wheat, we've got oats, we've got barley, and maybe millet or some other grain. In America, we've really cut down, and I think we've got like 4 or 5 grains we use, and there's like hundreds of grains that should be grown that would protect us from any of these blights, droughts, pests, etc., and also create more diversity in our diet. We'd be able to get more vitamins and nutrients from our food rather than having to take supplements, since each grain is going to have different amounts of certain amounts of supplements, etc., nutrients and oils and lipids that we need to function, and we just don't do it. So if you're going to do free food in that way, it does have to be something that doesn't have to be processed.
It seems hard. How we would get from here to there without heavy government leadership on it. Like, I mean, we can encourage people to have their own gardens, but when it comes to diversity and grains, it seems to me somebody at the top's got to say, this is good. A, we're not going to put aspartame in our food. We're not going to wait until people get cancer. It's not like the libertarian approach.
Yeah.
Eat the junk. You get sick. You won't eat it anymore. We just say, we're not going to put this in our food anymore.
Yeah.
So it seems like it's a combination. Also, maybe if we had a law against pesticides and fruits and vegetables, it may... then you'd have to have locally grown stuff, right?
Well, you could and you couldn't. I generally, in my political research, when you have restrictive laws, people, they kick back really hard. Uh-huh. And it's harder to get those restrictive laws passed and sort of embraced. Whereas if you're approaching it as, you know, government working with our farmers,
yes,
government working with, let's say, Jeep wants to become a farmer.
I do.
And that's what he wants to do. And the government is, whether it's hosting training courses or developing a seed bank in each individual local area so people can communicate. I wrote a huge thesis on how this could actually be done. I'm not going to bore you with it. But
somehow it will be competitive. They could compete in the same market with your big supermarkets.
You'd definitely have that, and you'd start to see over 20 years you'd start to see less of a market competition unless you're dealing with processed foods. You know, restaurants would still have a viable market position because plenty of times we don't want to cook our own food, and that's part of why we go to processed foods. But you could still go to a restaurant, pay somebody to be cooking your food for you, etc. But if you're, you know, down and out on your luck and you've got nothing else, you can still walk down to the local park and pick some apples, pick some peaches, maybe harvest some yarrow, whatever's around there that you would need. So we'd also need to have training. You know, people would need to know, what can you eat, what can't you eat, how do you take care of yourself with these medicinal plants if you can't access, you know, more expensive
Pfizer. Yeah, well, that, the medicinal aspect of it is a huge part of it, because that, again, we talk about the conflict with industry, and the pharmaceutical industry does not want us to move in that direction.
No, it's not. Why would they? They've got absolutely nothing to gain from it. So
we just have about 8 minutes left in the show. So if you'd like to call us, speak to Elliot Jeep and myself, Ken McDermott Rowe, about the food policy, about what you're eating, give us a ring at 203-336-9756, 203-336-9756. The name of the show is In Context. We're on every Monday from noon to 1, except the first Monday of the month. Our website is incontextreport.com. So you would like to go into farming, Jeep?
It's part of what I was talking about last time I was on the show, is basically living outside of the economy, because it's like, I don't feel like I have a place, and like we were talking about before.
Homesteading. Yeah,
exactly.
A lot of people are doing that.
Because I don't feel like, at this point, you know, I can't just go out and get a job. I've been like an artist for too long, you know?
And food, you got to eat.
Yeah, so you have to eat. And it's like, my ideal situation is, you know, I, you know, build a small home and, you know, have a good enough tract of land that I can grow seasonal vegetables that I can sustain myself on, and then, you know, make enough money through, you know, doing art, graphic design, making beats, DJing, etc., to be able to pay the only remnant of my association with the capitalist economy, which would be taxes on my land. Because,
right.
And that's the frustrating thing, no matter what you do, you don't own anything.
That's right.
You
know? You've got, of course,
you're
that's local
always
government
renting it from the government.
Exactly. Yeah, you're going to have to pay that. Would you hunt?
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I grew up hunting as a child, so.
So you wouldn't.
Yeah, so I mean, I know how to field dress stuff and whatnot. And also another thing is, you don't necessarily need to hunt. You can get on a list. Basically, you contact your local DOT or whatever and get on a list where basically, you know, they call you up. It might be 3 a.m, but they'll be like, hey, you know, there's a moose. There was a deer here.
The roadkill option.
Yeah.
Honestly,
if you
that was popular in
Pennsylvania. if you know how to field dress something, it's a really great way to get. You can get like a good 20, 30, 50 pounds of meat out of like one deer that got hit, and you know, depending on how effed up the animal got in the accident. I mean, if it got hit by a semi, you're probably not going to yield a lot. But if it, you know, got hit by a Volvo and the Volvo took the brunt of the action and the deer, you know, eventually, hopefully the person, you know, killed it in the accident. But either way, you know, you can get on a list where, you know, you just get, you know, 3-4 times a year, you probably get some free meat. And
Right? Yeah. In other words, you'd have to refrigerate, which gets you to the energy issue, which means it'd be nice if you could also be independent somehow from that, the grid on that.
Well, you can run a solar panel, you can create an independent solar system easily.
There's some fascinating advances with solar they've been doing where you can
produce
amazing amount of energy with one panel even. You know, you can run a whole wood shop.
Just think of the political implications. If you could grow your own food, get your own meat from hunting or wherever, and be off the grid as far, or at least not entirely off the grid, maybe still be connected, but supply most of your energy from your solar panels, how it would decentralize power in this country? Political power in this country.
Independent economies, they would get very upset. I could imagine that they would, you know, literally send agents out, like literally marshals or something like that, and be like, you have to desist.
Well, that's what happened to Michael Reynolds.
Yeah, exactly, the dude in Taos.
Yeah, Garbage Warrior.
What was it? Could tell the story of that.
It's fascinating. Michael Reynolds basically designed a house that takes care of you. It doesn't need to be connected to anything. What's great is you can build them in locations where it's hard to get power lines or sewer lines. They harvest all their own water. It reuses the water like 3 or 4 times before it leaves the building. The water is treated, black and gray water is treated in the building using a little bit of science, but a whole lot of plants and natural systems. So you're also producing food in your house with a large greenhouse. The way that their passive solar design, they never need to be heated, they never need to be cooled, and they're always designed with solar or wind power integrated. So he's totally off the grid, and what he did was he bought a whole lot of land out in New Mexico and had all these people who'd been helping him design and experiment with these buildings and said, I went just, you know, let's all live together, let's all be in this area. They all did bids for plots, paid money for plots of land, and after they'd started construction, the city came in and was like, what are you doing? You're the one who says you live here, but there's like 8 different families on this property. And he says,
we're
a community. We're like a subdivision. That's just, it's all paid for. It's all legal. And they're like, no, it's not. You messed up with Taos zoning, and you need to be a legal subdivision if you're going to have this many people here. So they had to shut everything down. I think people had to leave their homes, and he had to pay to bring in all of the electric, all of the sewer, all the water.
Stuff you didn't really need.
Things that nobody there needed and nobody wanted. And that was part of why they were living there, was they didn't want to be on the grid at all. But they had to do that. And then over years, he lobbied and really worked hard to get experimental building code and zone legislation into place.
So you need to start with a lawyer, probably. Unfortunately. No. I mean, if you're going to be Taos, which is a very...
If you're going to grow to like a big community, yes. Yeah, but if you're just going to be, you know... Yeah. On your own,
right?
You probably won't.
Yeah, stay below the radar.
Have any problems with zoning?
As long as it. But again, that gets back to the whole. It's very hard to do communal living in this country. They want you to be an individual homeowner, and it's very hard to say, well, no, I never function well alone. I always do better with family or friends around me. A group of like 5 people makes the load a lot lighter as far as finances. It also makes workload lighter.
The way we live now isn't the way people lived for millennia.
We're tribal cultures, you know. Now people just. You know, I want to live by myself. Oh, I want to be by myself.
And that goes with
the
consumerist
culture. I can't speak much to that because I've been living by myself for...
I don't know anybody who wants to live by themselves. It's usually like, I don't want to live
with
my
mom.
I want to
live in solitude.
Yeah, most people want to live with other people, but they feel that there's the, you need to be the white picket fence,
it's a lifestyle we've gotten into, and it plays into consumerism because they want you to own the car, the detached house, and all the
accessories that make you a good citizen.
Exactly. And, you know, the modern society, though, does have some potential in that the internet would give you, let's say you're living in the middle of nowhere, you could do your graphic design from no place, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And then I can just ride into town on a bike or whatever and, you know, stop at a Starbucks
and send it out. Yeah. So the internet could really open us up to decentralization.
I would say more it opens it up to be able to produce these independent economies.
You know,
that are based around transferring data. But then you also have somebody figuring out, oh, well, if I control the flow of this data, I can control these people who are depending on it to be able to...
Well, that's going to be the tug of war, between the central government and us individuals who want to use the internet. But it seems to me that in this country, we've got a lot of places that are inexpensive to live, to grow food.
Mm-hmm.
If you could just use the internet, if we had universal broadband and let people live all over the place and reinvent local communities, growing their own food, making their living off the net somehow, it would be really good for this country politically and socially as well as economically.
Yeah, and it would be the, you know, the real ideal of, you know, what the founding fathers were all about.
The Jefferson agricultural ideal.
That's right.
Exactly.
Each person. And what's fascinating, you know, I did a report on that at one point, and someone said, but he had slaves. And I was like, well, yeah, but now,
everybody did.
Now we have exponentially more information than we ever did before. We don't need the kind of human labor that at that point they hadn't figured it out. They hadn't figured permaculture out. How do you companion plant? How do you make less work for yourself and get a humongous yield of food?
Yeah. Well, actually, the people who had figured it out, they all got, you know, 86th off their land.
Yeah, unfortunately, guys with the better mousetrap.
Hey, guys, we know you've been living here for a while and really being harmonious with the environment. We need to help you savages by destroying your culture and putting you on land that doesn't
yield
anything.
Gets to the whole idea. I wish we had more time because we would talk about that neocolonialism and how that plays into agriculture. We didn't get that. Maybe we'll do that in another show.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, we are coming to the end of our show. We've got to go to the PSAs shortly. But I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to thank Elliot Snaith for joining with us to talk about food, sharing her knowledge, and Jeep co-hosting this week. And next week, you'll be here, right?
Yeah, I'll be here next week.
The 20th. That'll be our next
show.
Being the joker. And Gus Cadavere should be back with us.
All right. Awesome.
So, all righty. So is there anything else you want to say before we sign off?
No.
A man, a few words. Okay.
I had to have a dramatic pause there.
So we'll go out with some
music.
And
no.
We'll see you next Monday at noon.
Yeah.
Would you guys like some Cokes?
Yes. Please. I want a big 2 liter because I heard that they're running a special at Mobile where you can get two of them for $3.
Oh,
and stay tuned for Rick Patron, who's up next.
It's 89.5 at WPKN.org. Holla.
No one likes us, I don't know why. We may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. But all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. We give them money, but are they grateful? No, they're spiteful and they're hateful. They don't respect us, so let's surprise them. We'll drop the big one and pulverize them.
Is trading in your car more hassle than it's worth? Then choose a real alternative. Donating your car to WPKN. Avoid the Blue Book Blues and the dealer drama and contribute to the diverse universe that is your WPKN. You'll get a sweet tax deduction and will feel that WPKN pride while you're out in your new ride. Donating is easy. Call 877-WPKN-CAR, 877-WPKN-CAR, or go straight to our website WPKN.org and follow the step-by-step instructions.
And when the day is
This is Peggy Nelson, co-host with Richard Feniger of WPKN's weekly arts and culture show called State of the Arts. Join us every Friday at noon to hear our conversations with area cultural organizations, theaters, actors and actresses, and other leading voices from the world of the arts, here at 89.5 FM and streaming at WPKN.org.
This is Lawrence Block on WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
This is Riley Pereira from Cub Scout, pack number 99. I came to visit WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, listeners-supported community radio. I'm going to get my Tiger Cub badge for this.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
This is Liz Becker. Did you know that you can hear local news each weekday evening at 6:55 p.m.? PKN producers are covering current events and important information relevant to our listening area with the assistance of our own team featuring Hazel Kahn, Tony Ernst, Melinda Tuhus, and Brendan O'Reilly of the Southampton Patch and CTNewsJunkie.com. We hope you'll join us Monday through Friday just before Free Speech Radio News.
This is Howard Thompson. I host the show Pure every Friday afternoon from 1 to 4, and my friend Chris France from the Talking Heads does the last Friday of each month. I want to remind listeners that WPKN is an alternative public radio station that depends on your financial support. In fact, you might want to consider becoming a sustaining member of WPKN by setting up a regular monthly donation to WPKN via our website. At WPKN.org's homepage, in the Support WPKN window, just pull down the one-time tab to monthly and proceed. It's that easy, and you help sustain WPKN. Thank you.
And good afternoon, and welcome to WPKN, 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut. And online at WPKN.org. Rick Petrone with you until 4 on the Jazz Sound. Thank you for listening to WPKN. I'm going to get things started today with, well, it's called Commitment, and it's a Jim Hall recording featuring Ron Carter, Al Foster, Tommy Flanagan, and the song is Walk Soft.